Welcome to The Change Lab, a podcast for people who are all about personal development, leaning into their potential, and becoming their best self. Just, you know, starting next Monday. I'm your host, Dr. Sasha Hines, and oh, it's Monday. Hello, and welcome back to The Change Lab after a little spring break hiatus. So spring is here. It is, in fact, snowing outside my window here, but everywhere else it seems to be spring. The shoots are shooting, the buds are budding, and in honor of the earth coming alive to play in spring, today we're going to be joined by Dr. Elaine O'Brien to talk about the power of play and how we can increase the joy in our lives. Elaine specializes in positive health and human movement and is a pioneer fitness leader and passionate expert in the psychology of human flourishing. From 1984 to 1994, she worked for the National Aerobics Championship as a judge and ultimately became the head judge, officiating events throughout the U.S. Elaine received her master's in applied positive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, where she studied under Martin Seligman, Chris Peterson, and Angela Duckworth, and her doctorate in kinesiology and human movement psychology from Temple University. Her recent book, The Power of Play, Optimize Your Joy Potential, which she co-wrote with Andrea Seidel, helps us understand with research and theory why, just like kids, we need to play. And in the show notes, I'll give you the link to Elaine's fun tracker, which you can download from her website at www.elaineobrienphd.com. All right, let's get to my conversation with my colleague, Elaine O'Brien, as we dig into why play is not a nice to have, but a need to have in our lives. Well, this is a huge treat for me, Dr. Elaine O'Brien. So Elaine and I went to the University of Pennsylvania. She graduated in 2008. I was in 2006, but we were still in those early pioneer classes. And then you got your doctorate in kinesiology and human movement, which is so cool, at Temple, the same year I graduated from Columbia. So we were doing stuff all at the same time.
Yes. What a thrill to see you, Dr. Sasha.
So awesome.
Yes. And one thing that really stands out is the work that Marty Seligman invited us to do on positive health and advancing that. And I think that was 2008, 2009 at the very beginning. And what a joy to sit next to you in the conference room and get to know you, like, personally and professionally, and just to advance the power of physical activity and health and well-being in the world. So yay.
Absolutely. And isn't it remarkable to think back then it was around 2008, and how fringe that research really was. So what Elaine is talking about is that we were in, was it University of South Carolina?
Yes.
And discussing how physical health impacts mental health, as if this was some great revelation back in 2008, which people are now shocking. Like, wait, what? But it really was. It was new, connecting the dots back then. The first time I ever heard the expression from the neck up and neck down, so Marty Seligman, so we both learned under Martin Seligman at UPenn, but he used to always say, you know, psychology is sort of divorced from the neck up to the neck down, i.e. all talk therapy is from the neck up, as if we're just disconnected brains.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was very offended when I heard Dr. Seligman told me I was the neck down person in the class. And actually what I did do was, thanks to our classmate, Susie Pileggi, knew that I was a dance fitness leader and professional. And so I would do energy breaks just to get you moving, because, you know, you felt like your head was going to explode going all day and thinking so deeply. Yep. and passionately. That was something, when I heard that neck down thing, I was just like, you know what, let me find out more. And I just want to say, Sasha, thank you for being a pioneer. You were like the first class. You were the first ones, took the lead, changed so many people's lives. And I'll say for me, just made this part of my life like so much richer and better. And just, I think that being in that first class, though, I mean, what a leap of faith.
Oh, it was so cool. I look back and had no idea you know, youth is wasted on the young. Well, that, I mean, I did love every second of it, so I didn't squander it, but I look back and only really internalize how lucky I was to be among truly just a pantheon of incredible psychologists that came to teach us. That was so unusual. I didn't realize how unusual that was. I mean, it was the greatest professors, the chair of this, the one big professor from each university was coming to teach us as a guest professor. So it was just unbelievable. Well, I'm so excited to have you on because I wanted to talk about your book, The Power of Play, Optimize Your Joy Potential. I want to talk about that phrase, joy potential. It's very cool. And I love that you have connected the dots between positive psychology and movement in your career and integrated the neck up to the neck down as it should be. So let's dive into this book. It's a great book. It's called The Power of Play. Let's talk about this phrase that you use in the title, joy potential. What do you mean by that? What does that mean?
So I think human potential is so interesting. And if we prioritize joy and well-being and happiness and feeling good, then we're more apt to get it. I think it's putting that possibility as a priority and just going for the gusto. And it's almost like having a play mindset. Maybe you don't have time to play for a half hour, but just even a couple minutes just to have a laugh or to like smile at the world. That was a sticker my mother got me years ago. And I remember that. It's just like, and culturally, which we do talk about across cultures, like smiling isn't valued in every culture. So it's having respect also around play and when it's maybe like the right time, place, or mood.
Because in your book, as I was reading through it, and I was thinking, so many brilliant people, I mean, objectively, people that we would look at and regard as world-class historical geniuses, Einstein, et cetera. So many of them say something about play as a part of their own process of genius in some way, even though they wouldn't necessarily describe it as such. But this idea that, and we know this for children, that play is at the heart of learning, of curiosity, and that the way that we learn is through play. And yet in adulthood, that connection doesn't seem so clear as it does in childhood. Why do we do this as we get older? We disconnect because it's a universal truth throughout our life course that doesn't stop, that in play is where we learn.
I love that so much. You hit the nail on the head, and we don't prioritize play as an adult. Oh, quit playing. But like, that's where the genius is and the transformation and the fulfillment. And also I think role modeling too is like such a beautiful thing. And, you know, playing with your children, playing with a dog, you just like, it's so great, but we don't value that. And we need to value that because it provides us with a whole host of well-being dimensions, from physical to mental health to family and community health. They could overlap psychologically, just helping people to raise up and lift themselves up. And one thing that I've been thinking about a lot in my writing is around these micro moments of play. So again, just like the few moments we had before time in our green room just lifted me up to see you and have a laugh or reminisce or savor. So I think these are things that, again, that positive psychology, right, that study of flourishing and happiness and well-being, the time is now to just close the negativity bias and open up to the possibilities of developing a more open play mindset.
I mean, gosh, I was really been marveling about this and thinking about this all week because this is not a topic I normally am thinking about all the time. But then as I was reading your book and I was thinking, hold on a second, as a child, I exercised a lot as an athlete. So it was always in some way kind of a job, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I played sports, which was always fun, but there was some end goal that felt to some extent a little bit like a job, even as a kid. It was like, you're doing this for some higher order goal, as opposed to just going out and having fun and playing around. So it's interesting because in adulthood, I don't love exercise, which seems odd because I have spent my whole life exercising. So one would think, well, wait, you don't really enjoy exercise. Like, what's that about? And I was thinking, oh, right. Because I don't in some way equate it with play. There's an aspect of work to it, right? And I think about the way that we engage in exercise as adults is actually not that much fun. It's not that much fun to go to the gym. I mean, I have to watch a show to make something more fun. I have to distract myself. No, I mean, seriously, I'm distracting myself from the exercise itself, but the exercise is ostensibly supposed to be fun. I play ice hockey. I played ice hockey last night. That's the one sport I still play competitively. I mean, it's Margarita League, Beer League hockey. I play B-League hockey. So it's just a ton of fun. But I was thinking about this, like, you know, we play what, once a week, but that's fun. I don't think of it as exercise. I think about it as a game. Yeah. It's totally different. And then I get on to my spin bike and I'm like, oh, I got to do this for 45 minutes or 40 minutes. What can I distract myself with?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love that you're doing ice hockey. That's genius. And I mean, talk about community and
teamwork
and just the whole skill set. And the
I'm like, don't get me started. I could talk about it endlessly.
Oh my God, I want to interview you about this. That's so great. It's again, finding something you love. And what an interesting observation about your own like athletic background as work, right? I wonder if you can just think about things you might like to do. So if you're like doing like a brisk hike in the mountains or something like that, or just that outdoor piece is like the research is showing that. I actually wrote about that in my capstone about using movement interventions for the greater good, about the power of like green exercise and just being out in nature, and also like ecologically, right? If we walk more, it's going to cut carbon. So there's a lot of strategies that, and that's one of the chapters we talked about, Environmental Explorer. But yes, the motivation, if we could think of a way to really boost motivation, I think that really will help people exercise more.
This is from Elaine's book, but this is pretty compelling. So research essentially shows that play of all kinds supports mental health and well-being, enhances the ability to concentrate, increases motivation, confidence, and optimism, builds valuable social bonds, strengthens mindful awareness and mental agility, gives jolts of energy that can last for hours, supports feeling vibrant, engaged, and truly alive. I want all of that. There's pills for this. Like, this is what we want. And I think in some way, though, in adulthood, we're afraid of play. We don't do it. And yet here, what you're telling me is that, what is it that play makes us, we're a little vulnerable when we play. We feel a little ridiculous, a little silly. And maybe that makes it feel a bit scary. But what you're telling me is that in that, taking that risk of letting yourself be a slight goofball, you get all of this valuable good stuff out of it.
For sure. I mean, even if you think about psychoneuroimmunology, right? If you think about your mind and how you can heal yourself, that healing yourself through laughter, and Norman Cousins, his book, Anatomy of an Illness, and how he got this terrible diagnosis. And he said that hospitals are no place for sick people, checked himself out of hospital with his doctor's permission, and then just surrounded himself with humor and like Marx Brothers and anything that really tickled him. And he actually did write that book based on him healing from that. So again, I think it's just really advocating for play, thinking of it as not frivolous. It's not. It's so important. And as adults, like, we want to protect our longevity. We want to put more life into our years. We don't want to live really long and not well. So by being playful, people treat us better. We have more social connections, all the resources that we talked about, that positivity upward spiral.
If you're working with someone, I don't know if you work with clients, but just as contemporaries, and you see people that maybe have more, as you call it, joy potential, they could amp up their sense of joy and play, but perhaps that muscle is a little bit atrophied. What would you say are some of the things that they can do? What would be the sort of the easy entry into a life of more play?
I think one thing is being more mindful about it, even thinking about what did you enjoy doing as a kid, and then maybe modifying. Another thing I think is really powerful is music is magic, and all the brain benefits of hearing music. And again, with Ellen Langer and Counterclockwise, how when people of a certain age, older people, were listening to music that was from their heyday, they actually got more youthful. So I think that's really powerful. And then just even having like dance break that every hour or so, you know, you just put on a song and just groove or move a little bit. Again, I think it's getting to know yourself. What do you love? And I think that we offer a lot of varieties of play in the book. So just like with exercise, there's something for everyone, just to be more open to it. Doing it with a friend doesn't have to be big. It could be quick and dirty and have fun.
I love it. What about things like solitaire that you do on your own? Is there a bang for the buck with doing things like that? Or is it really, is the juice in the social nature of play?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's juice in the social, and that doing games, solitaire, I like that. It calms my mind. It's a little bit of a skill. It just, you know, kind of just changes things. I try and do it with good posture if I'm playing. But like, you know, I think it's really valuable. And different types of games, right? It's like cross training, right? That variety of the spice of life, that engagement. And when you mix it up, it's more complexity. It's great for your whole brain, your whole body. So good for you.
You mentioned Norman Cousins, and he said, playfulness is the bottom line. It's the most important thing. It's the most important thing. Ooh. So if playfulness is the most important thing, and I think a lot of us have lost our sense of playfulness, we have a hard time accessing our sense of playfulness. What do we do?
Ooh, what do we do? Well, today I wasn't sure. I was excited, but had some stuff going on. So I had to wear a feather dress.
No, I know. I noticed that. I love
it. Feather jumpsuit. You know what? I'm dressing up for my friend and her audience. It. So again, being in the moment, trying to find opportunities to have a laugh, like try not to take things seriously. I mean, like when SHI, you know what happens. And like, you just feel like, oh my gosh, I can't play. That's the furthest thing from my mind when you really probably would like benefit from it the most. Again, like the social connections that our dear beloved Dr. Chris Peterson talked about people mattering in the world, like getting with other people. And also I think that many times when we can help another person, it lifts us up. But there's probably somebody who's could use a smile or just like, you know, pat on the back or a hug or something, you know, helpful.
When you're talking about play, do you mean a game? Is there some formal definition that you have of, I mean, I know there's individual differences, but is there some sort of parameter around what you mean by play and how play is different than humor? Or, you know, is there something specific that defines play?
It's really new science. Dr. Stuart Brown talks a lot about play. And one of the consensus is that there's really no definition for play. It's emerging and it's heuristic and just like really open to possibilities. So with play, it could be games. It could be art, dance, sport, entertainment. It's anything that kind of lifts you up to help, again, boost your joy potential. Mm-hmm. There's so many possibilities, like even to get out a periodical and look at the entertainment section. If you feel like, you know, what can I do? Or the arts, probably when you're playing ice hockey, does that happen? Like time kind of either goes fast or stands still for you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So there's
depending on how I'm playing. No, depending on what kind of shape I'm in. Yeah, it goes fast or slow. But definitely, you know, when you're so engrossed in something, it's like that is not retrospectively, it's just the best feeling in the world. You lose that sense of time. And in the moment, you lose a sense of self-consciousness. You know, you're not even aware of yourself in any way. And then you kind of come back online like, oh, I was just doing something for hours and I was absorbed in it. And I was so absorbed in it that I forgot that I needed to go to the bathroom. I forgot that I was hungry. You kind of completely lose touch with yourself, which ironically is a positive experience.
Yes, that you said that so perfectly. And I think about one of the studies with Dr. Csikszentmihalyi and Lefebvre, how time on screen reduces your flow. And this was one of their early studies. And kids are on screens more than ever. So, you know, again, like with playing solitaire, you're playing with cards or you're playing on a screen, I guess. But more than that, I think that just to be aware of play that is balanced, that is diverse.
In that study, what was the mechanism? I mean, what were they looking at, just being on a screen and then someone's amount of flow in their life? Or is there something about a screen that disconnects us?
I think it was like a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. That it just diminished the potential. I want to definitely look at that study again, but it always stood out to me.
Oh, I'm going to look it up. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I just think, and more than ever, it really matters. There's so much we can learn. I was actually looking at the news today and they had pictures of babies in Scandinavia and they were like at daycare and they're covered with mud and they were like so happy. I had never really seen something like that before. And it made me smile just to think about, wow, you know, like that's one of the happiest places in the world, according to, you know, the World Happiness Report that just came out. What can we learn, you know, by looking? Who are the exemplars of play? And again, for me, like you're somebody who totally stands out. So yay.
I tried. I wanted to ask you this. Did you have a playful family? Did you grow up in a playful family where that was a value that was expressed in your family?
You know, I have to say, my dad was pretty playful. He would take us on picnics and play ball. And he went out to get us a dog one day and he came back with a duck. And he was just a real character. He was just so much fun. He was one of seven brothers. So they were always like cutting up and having fun. And my mom was more stern. Whereas with Andrea, my co-author on this book, her mother like would have a party when she got her braces off or every occasion. So it's just like a really nice balance. So yeah, thanks for asking about that. I think playing, you know, I remember playing tag with my cousins and going to the playground and just like street play, right? You can play for free, even if economics is a concern, right? There's play for everybody.
Oh, it's just ubiquitous. I mean, kids are just playing with everything. You can just take any object in your kitchen and turn it into something for a child. It's unbelievable how creative they are in terms of their ability to turn anything into some sort of game. Kids are just remarkable at it.
And it's so good for development. I know that's your area of your doctorate. And just like, even for me, I was feeling like a little down. So I picked up the drums. I started taking drum lessons and it just was like, this is great. It just got me out of my head for a little bit and made me a better person in some weird way.
But it's interesting because, you know, my area where I focus on is adult development and there's really not much emphasis on play at all. I mean, my theoretical framework in a constructive developmental perspective, there's nothing about play. But I think it's so interesting as you begin to think about it, what is it, you know, in positive psychology, we focus and study what makes life worth living. And play is one of the things that actually makes life worth living. And whether that's intellectual play, like this is so fun for me to just get to connect with you and chat about ideas, right? It's a fun thing for me. I love that kind of stuff. Engaging in play, whether that be intellectual play or physical play or whatever it is, a game of some sort, it is what makes life worth living. It is where our source of joy and laughter often is. It's one of the things that makes kids, I think, such a life-changing, remarkable part of our lives is that all of a sudden it's like humor's back in your life in a way that it wasn't. You know, all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I have just nonstop laughter because kids are do all sorts of hilarious things. And they're also exasperating, but it's not a central part of adult life. Is so much of the self-help, personal development space. If you go look on those bookshelves, it's about productivity. It's about efficiency. It's about getting things done. And ostensibly one could say, oh yes, that's so that you can get as much done so then you can have more time for play. But it's indirect. It's an indirect relationship. But you know, psychotherapy, and most of these sort of healing modalities for mental health have nothing to do with play. All you're doing is you're in your head, you're talking, you're analyzing things, you're trying to perhaps uncover and recognize particular patterns, experience different emotions, et cetera. But there's no emphasis on play at all. And I was really struck by this as I was reading your book and I was thinking, hold on a second. Play is such a central aspect of it's like the catalyst of joy and awe and wonder and humor and all these wonderful feel-good emotions and connection. And then it has all these wonderful physiological benefits too. And yet, when we're talking about our mental health, play is not even on the table.
You're giving me chills. Thank you so much for getting it. And I think that one interesting thing is that one of the leaders in psychology is Dr. Corey Keyes, and he spoke about flourishing. He has a book and he talks about languishing, like when things aren't going so well and you're kind of blah, right on the number line of well-being to not doing well. And he was just quoted in Time magazine talking about the power of play. Not the book, but just about how play is really important. And again, the reasons that you talked about with children and why it's so good developmentally and socially, emotionally, physically for kids to play. The same goes. Like, where did it turn off? As a person of a certain age, like, I have to say that in my doctoral research, what I did was I looked at older women who had engaged in this dance fitness class for 5 years or more, just a long time, mm-hmm. and would attend class twice a week or more. And the class was based on cardiovascular flexibility, strength training, muscular strength, muscular endurance, agility, and then balance, and then social fitness. So it was a welcoming atmosphere. Wanted to try and have people leave wanting a little bit more, feeling great, connecting to each other, and became very social. So we found about 67 women that fit this criteria. And this was from a program I had designed in 1991 to reduce the risk of alcoholism and drug abuse. And my idea was, like, let's do dance fitness. And so we got together, and what we found when we looked at the well-being of the participants, and again, with the it was welcoming, connecting, and music that was fun, from like just eclectic music from different genres, right? So mm-hmm. we found that these women of a certain age, from 55 to 83 years, were doing really well. I mean, they were just really contributing to the community. And then we found their children and even grandchildren were doing well by virtue of this, like, 1 hour fitness class twice a week over time. And Caroline Miller, who was your guest recently, who we both adore, she identified the legacy effect that was in my study, that emerged from the study. So if you make it fun, and I think fitness is like a superpower for leaders. I think that's really full stop, that, you know, when you're fit, we can perform better, we can love better, we can live better and well, right? And then help others and ourselves. So I guess the point is that the class was fun. And we did the class up until the pandemic, but the students kept meeting and had birthday parties every month. Just so exciting. And they're real proud of themselves, as they should be.
So yeah. What you're saying is that their fitness and their joy, you found in the study that there was a positive legacy in their younger generations and their family?
Yes.
That's amazing. And in what way? In terms of flourishing, human flourishing?
So what we did was interview with each of the participants, and then we also interviewed their children to find out, like, their opinions about how their mom was and how they were doing, and to get their points of view. And everybody was pretty uplifted.
I'm just so interested in this. Was the younger generation reporting about the older generation and saying they, as a third party, they were recognizing the boost that their, you know, either their mother or their grandparent was getting in this by virtue of being in this class?
Yes, because they were like these positive role models of self-determination. So there was this mastery. They were really doing well in, like, contributing to a community, contributing to their families. There was the relationship part of the self-determination. And then there was that, so the connectedness, relationship, and autonomy, that they were able to live their lives and just, like, have.
That's awesome.
You know, like, be able to drive. And one thing that we did with this particular group was it brought them to a fifth grade class, and we did, like, the gym class together and put on eclectic music, against some things that the kids might know and some things that both, and then the older. And some of the kids couldn't keep up with it, like the 70 and 80 years old people. But it was like there was so much joy in that room, the connections, just the fun, and again, the music, the moving your body, and just feeling good. I think it was just really one of the most powerful things. I wrote about that in Positive Psychology News. I think so. It's just, yeah, it was really, really fun.
I love that. It's Positive Psychology in Action. But again, I mean, I think this is so important to talk about, which is, intuitively, what you're describing to me sounds so healing and warm and life affirming, right? I'm like, oh, I can feel the energy in a room like that where you've got, you know, the octogenarians boogieing down with a bunch of kids. Like, that sounds fun to me, right? So I can totally feel that energetically, that that would be so much fun and awesome and life affirming. And yet, why do we have this narrow idea that the way that we actually get mentally well is we sit in a room and one-on-one and have a conversation about what's going wrong? How did we do this? Why did we decide that this was the way to go? I don't know. I'm serious.
I think we should talk about this and do a presentation about, like, group, like, just
I'm serious. Like, in some way, the group exercise thing is not considered as elevated or as important, but I would beg to differ. There's way more life force energy in what you're describing than there is in a one-on-one psychoanalysis, you know?
Bingo, bingo. I mean, it's not valued. And there's like this frivolity around, you know, fun and play and movement that's, you know, there was a painter in our community and he was like walking down the street stretching and people were looking at him. He's like, it feels really good to do that. One thing I do is when I'm brushing my teeth is tap my toes just so you get stretch your dorsiflexion for your calf stretch. Helps you with your balance, you know. So there's things that you could do, but I mean, that's maybe not as big a deal as doing it in public, but.
I mean, I think you're onto something here because what you're describing is someone who's not self-conscious about their moving their body in public and they're putting their self-consciousness to the side. But if you think about what gets us into mental trouble, extreme self-consciousness, right? I mean, when we start navel gazing and kind of get obsessed with ourselves and we're overly focused on us, in AA, what do they tell you to do? Go be of service to somebody else. Go do something for someone else. Get outside of yourself. In every single spiritual tradition, they tell you to do the same. You know, like if you want to feel better, do something for someone else. Be of service. Why do we love flow so much? We love flow so much because we're not self-conscious. We lose a sense of our body. We lose a sense of, we're so engrossed in what we're doing that we become the puzzle. We become the piece of art. We become the writing or whatever. We get so merged with the object of our interests and our focus that we lose ourselves to the one, to this bigger thing, right? It's like, it's a transcendent experience in some way. And so play requires that we transcend ourselves. We can't be self-conscious in play. Have you ever tried to play charades and feeling self-conscious? It doesn't work. It makes it not fun. The minute you start getting self-conscious, it's no longer fun. The same is true with anything, with comedy or improv, or the minute an athlete starts getting self-conscious, they start to play poorly, right? So there's something about play that asks us, or is like the ingredient or the condition of play is a lack of self-consciousness. And I think that's what adults have so much trouble with.
Oh, that's so well said again. I think you're right about the self-consciousness, right? If you can just get past that and just know that it's so healing and it's beneficial and necessary. There are so many different ways to play, but our bodies are meant to move. And I think that's one of the best ways that you can just like lift up your heart and your brain and your mind and your body and get out in nature, you know, smell the flowers, take a moment, be grateful for something. I think that can help get you out of your self-consciousness.
So in sense, like when we think about Barbara Fredrickson and all of those positive emotions that she's describing, and I will not get them all, but you know, help me out here. It's like amusement, joy, awe, curiosity.
Happiness.
Happiness, hope. Is hope one of hers?
Yes, I think. And is contentment one? Like a more
contentment,
positive?
Serenity. There's nine. I'm not going to get them all, but there's nine positive emotions that are the main positive emotions in her research. And the whole broad and build theory is that we develop positive emotions from an evolutionary perspective in order to broaden our perspective and build our psychological and social and physiological resources. And so they're equally as important to negative emotions in keeping us alive and the thriving of our species, but they work in a different way. They kind of open the aperture. And the aperture either must be open or you have to be willing to allow it to be open in order to play.
Yes. And I mean, what you said is so true. And that we have that negativity bias that's so prevalent, right? Art, this primitive feeling that we have to say, stop. Okay, it's okay to let our guard down, to let our hair down, and to just, again, let the self-consciousness go by the wayside, you know, even for a moment. And then it gets to be an upward spiral, like a good habit. You know, freestyle dance is one of the best things you can do, just like to shake it out, or even the Tarzan yell. Just like, it's good for your lymphatic system. I mean, but when you have that joy potential and through the power of play, it lays down a foundation of resilience. So that when things aren't going so hot, you can handle it. It gives you those resources that you just mentioned so well. I think that's really important to be able to have that foundation.
What do you do every day to amp up your positive emotions through play?
Oh my gosh, I have a puppy. She's 3 years old. She's Lola, a Sato from Puerto Rico. It's so funny. I said to my husband, will I ever be able to travel again? Because we're so in love with our puppy and we're so lucky. We live 5 blocks from the beach. So every day I take her for a walk. So it's like we both get a good workout and it's just so much fun. And I try and keep in touch with friends. I call a friend. And I just got together through Positive Psychology Connect with somebody. I haven't talked to a friend from like high school who used to drive me to school and so much fun. But music, trying to dance. Last thing besides the drums is water fitness. I have taught water fitness for like 20 something years and I'll be teaching this summer again. And I'm actually writing a book about this along with Positive Movement, but there's a natatorium near my home. So I've been going 3 or 4 days a week and it's hilarious to me. It's one of the best workouts. And I don't mean to be flip, but if people could do water fitness, like get past getting in the bathing suit and get in the pool, there would be so much more peace in the world. It's just lovely. It's so good for you. What do you do for fun?
I was thinking about this because, you know, I'm a mom of a 13 and a 10-year-old, and I think it's easy for me to just tell myself I'm exhausted. So again, the thing about play, which is interesting, is that you have to pay to play, right? You've got to put the energy in to get the benefit out. So I think it's easy in the moment to sort of be a little bit of a creature of inertia, like, ugh, I'm too tired. I don't feel like it. I'm not in the mood. But then when you get going, you're so glad you did. And then you get 10x return on the investment, almost always.
Amen.
And I think that there's so many times that it's really easy to talk myself out of doing something that's more playful because I'm like, I'm tired, or and I want to take a break. But whenever you do those things, you always feel so much better, but it can feel like such a heavy lift sometimes to get going, to make yourself go do something that's like, okay, it's a little more fun. Like I'm going to stop scrolling Instagram, which is just, I've gotten nothing out of it. And I just feel grody about humanity. But yet I spent the last 30 minutes glued to this thing because I can't rip myself away. And in that moment, you know, you get a lot more out of anything that would be more playful that you're doing with someone else, even with yourself, like you get so much more out of it. I think it's easy to kind of feel beleaguered or tired, exhausted, because it does take energy to start, but then right, it creates its own energy sort of. Let me give you an example. I'm sort of talking around this. My daughter, the other week, we went skiing and she had made a list. This is what I mean by kids are just intuitively so good at this. She made a list of, okay, we're going to do a bump run and we're going to do, you know, one run that's really hard. And then we're going to do one run that has this word in it. Anyway, she made a game of where we're going to go on the mountain to make it more interesting, to make it more playful. That's what she did. And she did it totally intuitively. And I think this is what kids are so good at. And adults, it's a skill that we atrophy the muscle over time. Our to-do list is a chore, but we can make it a game. Doing the dishes is a chore, but we could make it a game. You know, there's all these things that we can do. We could do it as a race against the clock. I mean, when I was a child and I would like clean my room and I would pretend like I was cleaning my room for some dignitary to come over, I would have some imaginary make-believe thing that made it more fun to do. And then in adulthood, we don't do this. We're like, oh, I've got all these chores to do. I've got X, Y, Z. And so kids naturally make their everyday life playful and adults make it onerous.
Yeah, I that is such a beautiful story, a great example. Your daughter, what fun, like to do that together.
Yeah, she's like, we're going to do one green, one blue run, one double diamond. You know, she kind of made it into a little bit of a scavenger hunt. And again, you know, I've made scavenger hunts for my kids. They're hard. They take effort to do, but the payoff is so huge. The energy to put into it is real, but the payout is enormous.
And what a gift for you that she did that for you. And again, role modeling. I mean, to me, one of the most playful persons I ever met was a student who started my class at age 89. And she was in my class till she was 101. And I went to her 100th birthday party, and it was like a martini birthday party. It was like wild. It was one of the most fun-filled parties, not counting the drinks, but like people were so gravitated to her sense of fun, her smile, her warmth. And what a great exemplar your daughter is in terms of like showing you like that, how much fun she just did this for you guys. And I think that what you said about, you know, the energy, right? So you want to have energy to match your desired needs. So again, all the different ways to play, let's say if you, maybe you play cards one night or something together, or the charades that you were talking about, the, you know, just there's in the book, we talk about spontaneous activities. I think it's great to plan activities. And then if you can have spontaneous, which are fun, spontaneous activities that you're just like making a little bit more playfulness in the day. It just makes these micro moments of goodness that really help to boost our positivity and well-being. I just love that she did that, Sasha.
So I'm sitting here reflecting and I'm thinking, oh, you know what? I'm good at the spontaneous big moments, not great at the day-to-day spontaneous. And so it's something I could really think about and work on, because kids are so fun because you can do whatever you want and they're like all in and they think it's awesome. They don't question it. They're not asking me, why are we doing this? They just are all in. So when my children were little, we started a tradition, which was a color party, and we would have a summer party that was based on the color. So everything has to be the same color. So one year is pink and the food has to be pink and you have to wear pink and the decorations are pink and everything is pink. So we've done pink and blue. I made deviled eggs that were looked like Smurfs. They were just... It looked disgusting, but I dyed the egg white blue. But we had everything was blue. And so we've done pink, blue, green, and we just did yellow this summer. We did yellow. I think maybe this summer we're going to do rainbow. So everybody is assigned a certain color. They've got to come with the food and dressed in the color. But anyway, it's completely random and made up. I mean, there's no, we're not celebrating anything other than just nothing, like just celebrating life. But it makes it fun. And then, of course, it's become its own thing. And now the kids look forward to it. But this is where kids are so brilliant, because they don't question it. They're not like, wait, why does that make sense? And why do we have to do this? And what's the point? You're like, there is no point other than it's just a random night. Let's just make it fun.
You know what? I have to say, when you were describing the color party, you were so animated even more. And like, you just were lit up from the inside out just talking about that. Like, if you see yourself, you just were just so happy.
It's so stupid. It's so stupid. But then we had all the moms got into it last year. Everybody dressed up. It was so much fun. It's so dumb and fun. And it was just great. But then I think day to day, I can lose sight of that. So I'm good at the punctuating with the kind of exclamation point of some, I love this spontaneous, fun and spontaneous thing. But I think about my day-to-day life less.
One of our chapters is about turning the mundane into the magnificent, like different things that you could do. And I mean, even just like to do a special dance before you walk in the door is something that Andrea talks about. I don't know if her mom did it, but at the door, she makes them dance before she comes in or something, you know, just having a laugh, you know, just what can you do? But I understand. And I mean, it requires like a little thoughtfulness.
It does. It requires some thoughtfulness. Is there a relationship with ritual and play?
Oh, yes. I think that is super powerful. Like even with your color party, that feels like a ritual, right? You've done
that. Oh, it's became one. It was just made up and then it's become one. Yeah.
And how special is that? It's like a sacred thing. It's something that you value, you look forward to. You have that anticipatory savoring where it's something you're looking forward to in the future. It's just the significance of doing the same thing in a way and being open to possibilities of new rituals to piggyback on.
Oh, absolutely. I love what you do. I love that you are giving, you know, science and evidence-based voice to the profound nature of being playful and how important it is. I love that so much, because I do think that we're at a bit of a reckoning with our field of psychology. If we want people to flourish, then we have to help people do the things that actually increase flourishing and not just unpacking the tough stuff. And they have to be done together, because in so many ways, the playfulness, the joy, that's what gives you the fuel to face the tough stuff, right? I mean, it's such a huge part of our psychological resilience is that ability to hunt the good stuff, find joy, find humor, and find little, as you said, micro moments of what makes life worth living. That's what gives us the fuel to face life's inevitable challenges.
Again, amen. So true.
Yeah. Well, now I just want to go to your fitness class because that sounds like a ton of fun.
Come on down.
Oh my God. My parents, by the way, my parents are so awesome. My dad is almost 80 and my mom just turned 77 and they go to Pilates 6 times a week. It's incredible. My mom and her ripped six pack. No, she's so strong.
Oh my
she
gosh.
Can just crush me in the gym. But I will say that they have so much fun and I can tell. Anyway, I got to go do a class with them because I'm sure I will just cackle with laughter.
Just be a fly on the wall. Oh my God. What, again, that positive role model, that legacy effect that they left you, right? With this playfulness, this fitness, and just like, it's so good. It's just so heartening to hear.
It is. It's so awesome. So what are you working on next? What's next for you academically and in life?
I'm very interested in positive psychology across cultures about, again, positive aging. And I'm writing a book about, again, the micro moments of fitness, about your space, your fitness, to be able to do fitness in your own place that you can build on that. So you were saying about going to the gym, why not like take 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there during the day and, you know, maybe supplement it with a 15-minute walk or whatever. So I'm writing about the power of positive movement. And then I'm also writing a book about water fitness, which again is so healing. When I was coaching and training athletes for the National Aerobics Championship back in the heyday of the sport, I would bring my athletes into the pool just to cross train and do explosive movements without the risk of injuries. So I developed this program called Splash Dance. What a feeling. So it's a class I'll be teaching this summer.
That's
and
fun.
I'm really excited about that. And I think that I did instructor training over the years and it's something I would love to keep doing and doing some coaching.
Well, I am here for it. So good to see you. What a treat for me.
Big hun. Thank you so much.
For more dirt on today's topic, make sure to visit the episode show notes at drsashahines.com. Or if you have any specific questions, you can shoot me an email at hello@thechangelabpodcast.com or find me on Instagram at drsashahines. If you're enjoying The Change Lab, there are 3 things you can do about it. Subscribe and leave me a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Share the show with a friend or 5. Or head over to drsashahines.com to check out the ways you can work with me and dive deeper into this work. And if you're feeling wild, maybe do all 3. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.